completing the task earned the chimp or child a treat, usually a piece of food for the chimp, a small toy for the child. Some of the tasks required thinking only about physical objects in physical space. For example, using a stick to pull in a treat that was out of reach, or choosing the dish that had the larger number of treats in it rather than the smaller number. Across all 10 tasks, the chimps and the 2-year-olds did equally well, solving the problems correctly about 68% of the time. But other tasks required collaborating with the experimenter, or at least recognizing that she intended to share information. For example, in one task, the experimenter demonstrated how to remove a treat from a clear tube by poking a hole in the paper that covered one end, and then she gave an identical tube to the chimp or child. Would the subjects understand that the experimenter was trying to teach them what to do? In another task, the experimenter hid the treat under one of 2 cups and then tried to show the chimp or child the correct cup by looking at it or pointing to it. The kids aced these social challenges, solving them correctly 74% of the time. The chimps bombed, solving them just 35% of the time, no better than chance on many of the tasks. According to Tomasello, human cognition veered away from that of other primates when our ancestors developed shared intentionality. At some point in the last million years, a small group of our ancestors developed the ability to share mental representations of tasks that 2 or more of them were pursuing together. For example, while foraging, one person pulls down a branch while the other plucks the fruit, and they both share the meal. Chimps never do this. Or, while hunting, the pair splits up to approach an animal from both sides. Chimps sometimes appear to do this, as in the widely reported cases of chimps hunting colobus monkeys. But Tomasello argues that the chimps are not really working together. Rather, each chimp is surveying the scene and then taking the action that seems best to him at that moment. Tomasello notes that these monkey hunts are the only time that chimps seem to be working together. Yet even in these rare cases, they fail to show the signs of real cooperation. They make no effort to communicate with each other, for example, and they are terrible at sharing the spoils among the hunters, each of whom must use force to obtain a share of meat at the end. They all chase the monkey at the same time, yet they don't all seem to be on the same page about the hunt. In contrast, when early humans began to share intentions, their ability to hunt, gather, raise children, and raid their neighbors increased exponentially. Everyone on the team now had a mental representation of the task, knew that his or her partners shared the same representation, knew when a partner had acted in a way that impeded success or that hogged the spoils, and reacted negatively to such violations. When everyone in a group began to share a common understanding of how things were supposed to be done, and then felt a flash of negativity when any individual violated those expectations, the first moral matrix was born. Remember that a matrix is a consensual hallucination. That, I believe, was our Rubicon crossing. Tomasello believes that human ultra-sociality arose in 2 steps. The first was the ability to share intentions in groups of 2 or 3 people who were actively hunting or foraging together. That was the Rubicon. Then, after several 100,000 years of evolution for better sharing and collaboration as nomadic hunter-gatherers, more collaborative groups began to get larger, perhaps in response to the threat of other groups. Victory went to the most cohesive groups, the ones that could scale up their ability to share intentions from 3 people to 300 or 3,000 people. This was the second step. Natural selection favored increasing levels of what Tomasello calls group-mindedness, the ability to learn and conform to social norms, feel and share group-related emotions, and, ultimately, to create and obey social institutions, including religion. A new set of selection pressures operated within groups. For example, nonconformists were punished, or at very least were less likely to be chosen as partners for joint ventures, as well as between groups. For example, cohesive groups took territory and other resources from less cohesive groups. Shared intentionality is Exhibit B in the retrial of group selection. Once you grasp Tomasello's deep insight, you begin to see the vast webs of shared intentionality out of which human groups are constructed. Many people assume that language was our Rubicon, but language became possible only after our ancestors got shared intentionality. Tomasello notes that a word is not a relationship between a sound and an object. It is an agreement among people who share a joint representation of the things in their world and who share a set of conventions for communicating with each other about those things. If the key to group selection is a shared defensible nest, then shared intentionality allowed humans to construct nests that were vast and ornate, yet weightless and portable. Bees construct hives out of wax and wood fibers, which they then fight, kill, and die to defend. Humans construct moral communities out of shared norms, institutions, and gods that, even in the 21st century, they fight, kill, and die to defend. Exhibit C. Genes and cultures co-evolve. When did our ancestors cross the Rubicon? We'll never know when the first pair of foragers worked as a team to pluck figs from a tree. But when we begin to see signs in the fossil record of cultural innovations accumulating and building on earlier innovations, we can guess that the innovators had crossed over. When culture accumulates, it means that people are learning from each other, adding their own innovations, and then passing their ideas on to later generations. Our ancestors first began to diverge from the common ancestor we share with chimps and bonobos between 5 million and 7 million years ago. For the next few million years, there were many species of hominids walking around on two legs in Africa. But judging from their brain size and their limited use of tools, these creatures, including Australopithecines such as Lucy, are better thought of as bipedal apes than as early humans. Then, beginning around 2.4 million years ago, hominids with larger brains begin to appear in the fossil record. These were the first members of the genus Homo, including Homo habilis, so named because these creatures were handymen compared to their ancestors. They left behind a profusion of simple stone tools known as the Oldowan toolkit. These tools, mostly just sharp flakes they had knocked off larger stones, helped Homo habilis to cut and scrape meat off carcasses killed by other animals. Homo habilis was not much of a hunter. Then, beginning around 1.8 million years ago, some hominids in East Africa began making new and more finely crafted tools known as the Acheulean toolkit. The main tool was a teardrop-shaped hand axe, and its symmetry and careful crafting jump out at us as something new under the sun, something made by minds like ours. This seems like a promising place to start talking about cumulative culture. But here's the weird thing. Acheulean tools are nearly identical everywhere, from Africa to Europe to Asia, for more than a million years. There's hardly any variation, which suggests that the knowledge of how to make these tools may not have been passed on culturally. Rather, the knowledge of how to make these tools may have become innate, just as the knowledge of how to build a dam is innate in beavers. It's only around 600,000 or 700,000 years ago that we begin to see creatures who may have crossed over. The first hominids, with brains as large as ours, begin appearing in Africa and then Europe. They are known collectively as Homo heidelbergensis, and they were the ancestors of Neanderthals as well as of us. At their campsites, we find the first clear evidence of hearths and of spears. The oldest known spears were just sharpened sticks, but later they became sharp stone points attached to wooden shafts and balanced for accurate throwing. These people made complex weapons and then worked together to hunt and kill large animals, which they brought back to a central campsite to be butchered, cooked, and shared. Homo heidelbergensis is therefore our best candidate for Rubicon crosser. These people had cumulative culture, teamwork, and a division of labor. They must have had shared intentionality, including at least some rudimentary moral matrix that helped them work together and then share the fruits of their labor. By crossing over, they transformed not just the course of human evolution, but the very nature of the evolutionary process. From that point onward, people lived in an environment that was increasingly of their own making. The anthropologists Pete Richardson and Rob Boyd have argued that cultural innovations, such as spears, cooking techniques, and religions, evolve in much the same way that biological innovations evolve, and the two streams of evolution are so intertwined that you can't study one without studying both. For example, one of the best understood cases of gene culture coevolution, occurred among the first people who domesticated cattle. In humans, as in all other mammals, the ability to digest lactose, the sugar in milk, is lost during childhood. The gene that makes lactase, the enzyme that breaks down lactose, shuts off after a few years of service because mammals don't drink milk after they are weaned. But those first cattle keepers in northern Europe and in a few parts of Africa had a vast new supply of fresh milk, which could be given to their children but not to adults. Any individual whose mutated genes delayed the shutdown of lactase production had an advantage. Over time, such people left more milk-drinking descendants than did their lactose-intolerant cousins. The gene itself has been identified. Genetic changes then drove cultural innovations as well. Groups with the new lactase gene then kept even larger herds and found more ways to use and process milk, such as turning it into cheese. These cultural innovations then drove further genetic changes, and on it went. If cultural innovations, such as keeping cattle, can lead to genetic responses, such as adult lactose tolerance, then might cultural innovations related to morality have led to genetic responses as well? Yes. Richardson and Boyd argue that gene culture coevolution helped to move humanity up from the small group sociability of other primates to the tribal ultra-sociality that is found today in all human societies. According to their tribal instincts hypothesis, human groups have always been in competition to some degree with neighboring groups. The groups that figured out, or stumbled upon, cultural innovations that helped them cooperate and cohere in groups larger than the family tended to win these competitions, just as Darwin said. Among the most important such innovations is the human love of using symbolic markers to show our group memberships. From the tattoos and face piercings used among Amazonian tribes, through the male circumcision required of Jews, to the tattoos and facial piercings used by punks in the United Kingdom, human beings take extraordinary, costly, and sometimes painful steps to make their bodies advertise their group memberships. This practice surely started modestly, perhaps just with colored powders for body painting. But however it began, groups that built on it and invented more permanent markers found a way to forge a sense of we that extended beyond kinship. We trust and cooperate more readily with people who look and sound like us. We expect them to share our values and norms. And once some groups developed the cultural innovation of proto-tribalism, they changed the environment within which genetic evolution took place. As Richardson and Boyd explain, quote, such environments favored the evolution of a suite of new social instincts suited to life in such groups, including a psychology which expects life to be structured by moral norms and is designed to learn and internalize such norms. New emotions such as shame and guilt, which increase the chance that the norms are followed, and a psychology which expects the social world to be divided into symbolically marked groups. End quote. In such proto-tribal societies, individuals who found it harder to play along, to restrain their antisocial impulses, and to conform to the most important collective norms would not have been anyone's top choice when it came time to choose partners for hunting, foraging, or mating. In particular, people who were violent would have been shunned, punished, or in extreme cases, killed. This process has been described as self-domestication. The ancestors of dogs, cats, and pigs got less aggressive as they were domesticated and shaped for partnership with human beings. Only the friendliest ones approached human settlements in the first place. They volunteered to become the ancestors of today's pets and farm animals. In a similar way, early humans domesticated themselves when they began to select friends and partners based on their ability to live within the tribe's moral matrix. In fact, our brains, bodies, and behavior show many of the same signs of domestication that are found in our domestic animals. Smaller teeth, smaller body, reduced aggression, and greater playfulness carried on even into adulthood. The reason is that domestication generally takes traits that disappear at the end of childhood and keeps them turned on for life. Domesticated animals, including humans, are more childlike, sociable, and gentle than their wild ancestors. These tribal instincts are a kind of overlay, a set of groupish emotions and mental mechanisms laid down over our older and more selfish primate nature. It may sound depressing to think that our righteous minds are basically tribal minds, but consider the alternative. Our tribal minds make it easy to divide us, but without our long period of tribal living, there'd be nothing to divide in the first place. There'd be only small families of foragers, not nearly as sociable as today's hunter-gatherers, eking out a living and losing most of their members to starvation during every prolonged drought. The coevolution of tribal minds and tribal cultures didn't just prepare us for war, it also prepared us for far more peaceful coexistence within our groups and, in modern times, for cooperation on a vast scale as well. Gene culture coevolution is Exhibit C in the retrial of group selection. Once our ancestors crossed the Rubicon and became cumulatively cultural creatures, their genes began to co-evolve with their cultural innovations. At least some of these innovations were directed at marking members of a moral community, fostering group cohesion, suppressing aggression and free riding within the group, and defending the territory shared by that moral community. These are precisely the sorts of changes that make major transitions happen. Even if group selection played no role in the evolution of any other mammal, human evolution has been so different since the arrival of shared intentionality and gene culture coevolution that humans may well be a special case. The wholesale dismissal of group selection in the 1960s and 1970s, based mostly on arguments and examples from other species, was premature. Now, I know there are a lot of species and events and dates, so let me put them all together in a list for you in Figure 9.1. Around 5 to 7 million years ago, the ancestors of humans diverged from ancestors of chimps and bonobos. Around 4 million years ago, Australopithecines such as Lucy emerge. Around 2.4 million years ago, the genus Homo, including Homo habilis, emerges. Around 1.8 million years ago, the Acheulean toolkit appears. Around 500 to 700,000 years ago, our ancestors cross the Rubicon. Shared intentionality enables cumulative culture and gene culture coevolution in Homo heidelbergensis. Hunting with spears plus cooking on hearths shows much more collaborative groups. Between 50 and 70,000 years ago, modern humans migrate out of Africa and the Middle East. Around 12,000 years ago, the Holocene begins. Agriculture and herding. Gene culture coevolution speeds up. Between 2 and 7,000 years ago, city-states and empires. In the year 2010, Facebook links 500 million people together. Exhibit D, evolution can be fast. When exactly did we become ultrasocial? Humans everywhere are so groupish that most of the genetic changes must have been in place before our ancestors spread out from Africa and the Middle East around 50,000 years ago. I suspect it was the development of cooperative groupishness that enabled these ancestors to conquer the world and take over Neanderthal territory so quickly. But did gene culture coevolution stop at that point? Did our genes freeze in place, leaving all later adaptation to be handled by cultural innovation? For decades, many anthropologists and evolutionary theorists said yes. In an interview in 2000, the paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould said that natural selection has almost become irrelevant in human evolution because cultural change works orders of magnitude faster than genetic change. He next asserted that there's been no biological change in humans in 40,000 or 50,000 years. Everything we call culture and civilization, we've built with the same body and brain. If you believe Gould's assertion that there's been no biological evolution in the last 50,000 years, then you'll be most interested in the Pleistocene era, the roughly 2 million years prior to the rise of agriculture, and you'll dismiss the Holocene, the last 12,000 years, as irrelevant for understanding human evolution. But is 12,000 years really just an eye blink in evolutionary time? Darwin didn't think so. He wrote frequently about the effects obtained by animal and plant breeders in just a few generations. The speed at which genetic evolution can occur is best illustrated by an extraordinary study by Dmitry Belyaev, a Soviet scientist who had been demoted in 1948 for his belief in Mendelian genetics. Soviet morality required the belief that traits acquired during one's lifetime could be passed on to one's children. Belyaev moved to a Siberian research institute, where he decided to test his ideas by conducting a simple breeding experiment with foxes. Rather than selecting foxes based on the quality of their pelts, as fox breeders would normally do, he selected them for tameness. Whichever fox pups were least fearful of humans were bred to create the next generation. Within just a few generations, the foxes became tamer. But more important, after 9 generations, novel traits began to appear in a few of the pups, and they were largely the same ones that distinguished dogs from wolves. For example, patches of white fur appeared on the head and chest, jaws and teeth shrank, and tails formerly straight began to curl. After just 30 generations, the foxes had become so tame that they could be kept as pets. Lyudmila Trut, a geneticist who had worked with Belyaev on the project and who ran it after his death, described the foxes as docile, eager to please, and unmistakably domesticated. It's not just individual-level selection that is fast. A second study done with chickens shows that group selection can produce equally dramatic results. If you want to increase egg output, common sense tells you to breed only the hens that lay the most eggs. But the reality of the egg industry is that hens live crammed together into cages, and the best-laying hens tend to be the more aggressive, dominant hens. Therefore, if you use individual selection, breeding only the most productive hens, total productivity actually goes down because aggressive behavior, including killing and cannibalism, goes up. In the 1980s, the geneticist William Muir used group selection to get around this problem. He worked with cages containing 12 hens each, and he simply picked the cages that produced the most eggs in each generation. Then he bred all of the hens in those cages to produce the next generation. Within just 3 generations, aggression levels plummeted. By the 6th generation, the death rate fell from the horrific baseline of 67% to a mere 8%. Total eggs produced per hen jumped from 91 to 237, mostly because the hens started living longer, but also because they laid more eggs per day. The group-selected hens were more productive than were those subjected to individual-level selection. They also actually looked like the pictures of hens you see in children's books, plump and well-feathered, in contrast to the battered, beaten-up, and partially defeathered hens that resulted from individual-level selection. Humans were probably never subjected to such a strong and consistent selection pressure as were those foxes and hens, so it would take more than 6 or 10 generations to produce novel traits. But how much longer? Can the human genome respond to new selection pressures in, say, 30 generations or 600 years? Or would it take more than 500 generations, 10,000 years, for a new selection pressure to produce any genetic adaptation? The actual speed of genetic evolution is a question that can be answered with data, and thanks to the Human Genome Project, we now have that data. Several teams have sequenced the genomes of thousands of people from every continent. Genes mutate and drift through populations, but it is possible to distinguish such random drift from cases in which genes are being pulled by natural selection. The results are astonishing, and they are exactly the opposite of Gould's claim. Genetic evolution greatly accelerated during the last 50,000 years. The rate at which genes changed in response to selection pressures began rising around 40,000 years ago, and the curve got steeper and steeper after 20,000 years ago. Genetic change reached a crescendo during the Holocene era in Africa as well as in Eurasia. It makes perfect sense. In the last 10 years, geneticists have discovered just how active genes are. Genes are constantly turning on and off in response to conditions such as stress, starvation, or sickness. Now imagine these dynamic genes building vehicles, or people, who are hell-bent on exposing themselves to new climates, predators, parasites, food options, social structures, and forms of warfare. Imagine population densities skyrocketing during the Holocene so that there are more people putting more genetic mutations into play. If genes and cultural adaptations co-evolve in a swirling waltz, as Richardson and Boyd put it, and if the cultural partner suddenly starts dancing the jitterbug, the genes are going to pick up the pace too. This is why genetic evolution kicked into overdrive in the Holocene era, pulling along mutations such as the lactose tolerance gene or a gene that changed the blood of Tibetans so that they could live at high altitudes. Genes for these recent traits and dozens of others have already been identified. If genetic evolution was able to fine-tune our bones, teeth, skin, and metabolism in just a few thousand years as our diets and climates changed, how could genetic evolution not have tinkered with our brains and behaviors as our social environments underwent the most radical transformation in primate history? I don't think evolution can create a new mental module from scratch in just 12,000 years. But I can see no reason why existing features, such as the six foundations I described in chapters 7 and 8, or the tendency to feel shame, would not be tweaked if conditions changed and then stayed stable for 1,000 years. For example, when a society becomes more hierarchical or entrepreneurial, or when a group takes up rice farming, herding, or trade, these changes alter human relationships in many ways and reward very different sets of virtues. Cultural change would happen very rapidly. The moral matrix constructed upon the six foundations can change radically within a few generations. But if that new moral matrix then stays somewhat steady for a few dozen generations, new selection pressures will apply, and there could be some additional gene-culture coevolution. Fast evolution is Exhibit D in the retrial of group selection. If genetic evolution can be fast, and if the human genome co-evolves with cultural innovations, then it becomes quite possible that human nature was altered in just a few thousand years somewhere in Africa by group selection during particularly harsh periods. For example, the climate in Africa fluctuated wildly between 70,000 and 140,000 years ago. With each swing from warmer to cooler or from wetter to drier, food sources changed and widespread starvation was probably common. A catastrophic volcanic eruption 74,000 years ago from the Toba volcano in Indonesia may have dramatically changed the Earth's climate within a single year. Whatever the cause, we know that almost all humans were killed off at some point during this time period. Every person alive today is descended from just a few thousand people who made it through one or more population bottlenecks. What was their secret? We'll probably never know. But let's imagine that 95% of the food on Earth magically disappears tonight, guaranteeing that almost all of us will starve to death within 2 months. Law and order collapse. Chaos and mayhem ensue. Who among us will still be alive a year from now? Will it be the biggest, strongest, and most violent individuals in each town? Or will it be the people who manage to work together in groups to monopolize, hide, and share the remaining food supplies among themselves? Now imagine starvations like that occurring every few centuries, and think about what a few such events would do to the human gene pool. Even if group selection was confined to just a few thousand years, or to the longer period between 70,000 and 140,000 years ago, it could have given us the group-related adaptations that allowed us to burst forth from Africa soon after the bottleneck to conquer and populate the globe. It's not all about war. I've presented group selection so far in its simplest possible form. Groups compete with each other as if they were individual organisms, and the most cohesive groups wipe out and replace the less cohesive ones during intertribal warfare. That's the way that Darwin first imagined it. But when the evolutionary psychologist Leslie Newson read an early draft of this chapter, she sent me this note. Quote, "I think it is important not to give readers the impression that groups competing necessarily meant groups being at war or fighting with one another. They were competing to be the most efficient at turning resources into offspring. Don't forget that women and children were also very important members of these groups." End quote. Of course, she's right. Group selection does not require war or violence. Whatever traits make a group more efficient at procuring food and turning it into children makes that group more fit than its neighbors. Group selection pulls for cooperation, for the ability to suppress antisocial behavior and spur individuals to act in ways that benefit their groups. Group-serving behaviors sometimes impose a terrible cost on outsiders, as in warfare. But in general, groupishness is focused on improving the welfare of the in-group, not on harming an out-group. In sum, Darwin believed that morality was an adaptation that evolved by natural selection, operating at the individual level and at the group level. Tribes with more virtuous members replaced tribes with more selfish members. But Darwin's idea was banished from the academic world when Williams and Dawkins argued that the free rider problem dooms group selection. The sciences then entered a three-decade period during which competition between groups was downplayed and everyone focused on competition among individuals within groups. Seemingly altruistic acts had to be explained as covert forms of selfishness. But in recent years, new scholarship has emerged that elevates the role of groups in evolutionary thinking. Natural selection works at multiple levels simultaneously, sometimes including groups of organisms. I can't say for sure that human nature was shaped by group selection. There are scientists whose views I respect on both sides of the debate. But as a psychologist studying morality, I can say that multi-level selection would go a long way toward explaining why people are simultaneously so selfish and so groupish. There's a great deal of new scholarship since the 1970s that compels us to think anew about group selection as a part of multi-level selection. I organized that scholarship into four exhibits that collectively amount to a defense of group selection. Exhibit A, Major Transitions Produce Superorganisms. The history of life on Earth shows repeated examples of major transitions. When the free rider problem is muted at one level of the biological hierarchy, larger and more powerful vehicles, superorganisms, arise at the next level up in the hierarchy, with new properties such as a division of labor, cooperation, and altruism within the group. Exhibit B, Shared Intentionality Generates Moral Matrices. The Rubicon crossing that let our ancestors function so well in their groups was the emergence of the uniquely human ability to share intentions and other mental representations. This ability enabled early humans to collaborate, divide labor, and develop shared norms for judging each other's behavior. These shared norms were the beginning of the moral matrices that govern our social lives today. Exhibit C, Genes and Cultures Co-Evolve. Once our ancestors crossed the Rubicon and began to share intentions, our evolution became a two-stranded affair. People created new customs, norms, and institutions that altered the degree to which many groupish traits were adaptive. In particular, gene-culture coevolution gave us a set of tribal instincts. We love to mark group membership, and then we cooperate preferentially with members of our group. Exhibit D, Evolution Can Be Fast. Human evolution did not stop or slow down 50,000 years ago. It sped up. Gene-culture coevolution reached a fever pitch during the last 12,000 years. We can't just examine modern-day hunter-gatherers and assume that they represent universal human nature as it was locked into place 50,000 years ago. Periods of massive environmental change, as occurred between 70,000 and 140,000 years ago, and cultural change, as occurred during the Holocene era, should figure more prominently in our attempts to understand who we are and how we got our righteous minds. Most of human nature was shaped by natural selection operating at the level of the individual. Most, but not all. We have a few group-related adaptations, too, as many Americans discovered in the days after 9/11. We humans have a dual nature. We are selfish primates who long to be a part of something larger and nobler than ourselves. We are 90% chimp and 10% bee. If you take that claim metaphorically, then the groupish and hivish things that people do will make a lot more sense. It's almost as though there's a switch in our heads that activates our hivish potential when conditions are just right. Chapter 10, The Hive Switch. In September 1941, William McNeil was drafted into the U.S. Army. He spent several months in basic training, which consisted mostly of marching around the drill field in close formation with a few dozen other men. At first, McNeil thought the marching was just a way to pass the time, because his base had no weapons with which to train. But after a few weeks, when his unit began to synchronize well, he began to experience an altered state of consciousness. Quote, words are inadequate to describe the emotion aroused by the prolonged movement in unison that drilling involved. A sense of pervasive well-being is what I recall. More specifically, a strange sense of personal enlargement. A sort of swelling out, becoming bigger than life, thanks to participation in collective ritual. End quote. McNeil fought in World War II and later became a distinguished historian. His research led him to the conclusion that the key innovation of Greek, Roman, and later European armies was the sort of synchronous drilling and marching the army had forced him to do years before. He hypothesized that the process of muscular bonding, moving together in time, was a mechanism that evolved long before the beginning of recorded history for shutting down the self and creating a temporary superorganism. Muscular bonding enabled people to forget themselves, trust each other, function as a unit, and then crush less cohesive groups. Figure 10.1 shows the superorganism that Alexander the Great used to defeat much larger armies. Figure 10.1 shows a formation of soldiers, 16 soldiers across, 16 soldiers deep, with spears pointing forwards. McNeil studied accounts of men in battle and found that men risked their lives not so much for their country or their ideals as for their comrades in arms. He quoted one veteran who gave this example of what happens when I becomes we. Quote, "Many veterans who are honest with themselves will admit, I believe, that the experience of communal effort in battle has been the high point of their lives. Their I passes insensibly into a we. My becomes our, and individual fate loses its central importance. I believe that it is nothing less than the assurance of immortality that makes self-sacrifice at these moments so relatively easy. I may fall, but I do not die, for that which is real in me goes forward and lives on in the comrades for whom I gave up my life." The Hive Hypothesis. In the last chapter, I suggested that human nature is 90% chimp and 10% bee. We are like chimps in being primates whose minds were shaped by the relentless competition of individuals with their neighbors. We are descended from a long string of winners in the game of social life. This is why we are Glauconians, usually more concerned about the appearance of virtue than the reality, as in Glaucon's story about the Ring of Gyges. But human nature also has a more recent groupish overlay. We are like bees in being ultra-social creatures whose minds were shaped by the relentless competition of groups with other groups. We are descended from earlier humans whose groupish minds helped them cohere, cooperate, and outcompete other groups. That doesn't mean that our ancestors were mindless or unconditional team players. It means they were selective. Under the right conditions, they were able to enter a mindset of one for all for one, in which they were truly working for the good of the group and not just for their own advancement within the group. My hypothesis in this chapter is that human beings are conditional hive creatures. We have the ability, under special conditions, to transcend self-interest and lose ourselves, temporarily and ecstatically, in something larger than ourselves. That ability is what I'm calling the hive switch. The hive switch, I propose, is a group-related adaptation that can only be explained by a theory of between-group selection, as Williams said. It cannot be explained by selection at the individual level. How would this strange ability help a person to outcompete his neighbors in the same group? The hive switch is an adaptation for making groups more cohesive and therefore more successful in competition with other groups. If the hive hypothesis is true, then it has enormous implications for how we should design organizations, study religion, and search for meaning and joy in our lives. Is it true? Is there really a hive switch? Collective emotions. When Europeans began to explore the world in the late 15th century, they brought back an extraordinary variety of plants and animals. Each continent had its own wonders. The diversity of the natural world was vast beyond imagination. But reports about the inhabitants of these far-flung lands were, in some ways, more uniform. European travelers to every continent witnessed people coming together to dance with wild abandon around a fire, synchronized to the beat of drums, often to the point of exhaustion. In Dancing in the Streets, A History of Collective Joy, Barbara Ehrenreich describes how European explorers reacted to these dances with disgust. The masks, body paints, and guttural shrieks made the dancers seem like animals. The rhythmically undulating bodies and occasional sexual pantomimes were, to most Europeans, degrading, grotesque, and thoroughly savage. The Europeans were unprepared to understand what they were seeing. As Ehrenreich argues, collective and ecstatic dancing is a nearly universal biotechnology for binding groups together. She agrees with McNeil that it is a form of muscular bonding. It fosters love, trust, and equality. It was common in ancient Greece. Think of Dionysus and his cult. And in early Christianity, which, she says, was a danced religion until dancing in church was suppressed in the Middle Ages. But if ecstatic dancing is so beneficial and so widespread, then why did Europeans give it up? Ehrenreich's historical explanation is too nuanced to summarize here, but the last part of the story is the rise of individualism and more refined notions of the self in Europe, beginning in the 16th century. These cultural changes accelerated during the Enlightenment and the Industrial Revolution. It is the same historical process that gave rise to weird culture in the 19th century, that is, Western, educated, industrialized, rich, and democratic. As I said in Chapter 5, the weirder you are, the more you perceive a world full of separate objects rather than relationships. The weirder you are, the harder it is to understand what those savages were doing. Ehrenreich was surprised to discover how little help she could get from psychology in her quest to understand collective joy. Psychology has a rich language for describing relationships among pairs of people, from fleeting attractions to ego-dissolving love to pathological obsession. But what about the love that can exist among dozens of people? She notes that if homosexual attraction is the love that dares not speak its name, the love that binds people to the collective has no name at all to speak. Among the few useful scholars she found in her quest was Emil Durkheim. Durkheim insisted that there were social facts that were not reducible to facts about individuals. Social facts, such as the suicide rate or norms about patriotism, emerge as people interact. They are just as real and worthy of study by sociology as are people and their mental states studied by psychology. Durkheim didn't know about multi-level selection and major transitions theory, but his sociology fits uncannily well with both ideas. Durkheim frequently criticized his contemporaries, such as Freud, who tried to explain morality and religion using only the psychology of individuals and their pairwise relationships. God is just a father figure, said Freud. Durkheim argued, in contrast, that Homo sapiens was really Homo duplex, a creature who exists at two levels, as an individual and as part of the larger society. From his studies of religion, he concluded that people have two distinct sets of social sentiments, one for each level. The first set of sentiments, quote, binds each individual to the person of his fellow citizens. These are manifest within the community in the day-to-day relationships of life. These include the sentiments of honor, respect, affection, and fear, which we may feel towards one another, end quote. These sentiments are easily explained by natural selection operating at the level of the individual. Just as Darwin said, people avoid partners who lack these sentiments. But Durkheim noted that people also had the capacity to experience another set of emotions. Quote, the second are those which bind me to the social entity as a whole. These manifest themselves primarily in the relationships of the society with other societies and could be called intersocial. The first set of emotions leaves my autonomy and personality almost intact. No doubt they tie me to others, but without taking much of my independence from me. When I act under the influence of the second, by contrast, I am simply a part of a whole whose actions I follow and whose influence I am subject to. End quote. I find it stunning that Durkheim invokes the logic of multi-level selection, proposing that a new set of social sentiments exists to help groups, which are real things, with their intersocial relationships. These second-level sentiments flip the hive switch, shut down the self, activate the groupish overlay, and allow the person to become simply a part of a whole. The most important of these Durkheimian higher-level sentiments is collective effervescence, which describes the passion and ecstasy that group rituals can generate. As Durkheim put it, quote, "The very act of congregating is an exceptionally powerful stimulant. Once the individuals are gathered together, a sort of electricity is generated from their closeness and quickly launches them to an extraordinary height of exaltation." End quote. In such a state, the vital energies become hyper-excited, the passions more intense, the sensations more powerful. Durkheim believed that these collective emotions pull humans fully, but temporarily, into the higher of our two realms, the realm of the sacred, where the self disappears and collective interests predominate. The realm of the profane, in contrast, is the ordinary, day-to-day world where we live most of our lives, concerned about wealth, health, and reputation, but nagged by the sense that there is, somewhere, something higher and nobler. Durkheim believed that our movements back and forth between these two realms gave rise to our ideas about gods, spirits, heavens, and the very notion of an objective moral order. These are social facts that cannot be understood by psychologists studying individuals or pairs any more than the structure of a beehive could be deduced by entomologists examining lone bees or pairs. So many ways to flip the switch. Collective effervescence sounds great, right? Too bad you need 23 friends and a bonfire to get it. Or do you? One of the most intriguing facts about the hive switch is that there are many ways to turn it on. Even if you doubt that the switch is a group-level adaptation, I hope you'll agree with me that the switch exists and that it generally makes people less selfish and more loving. Here are three examples of switch flipping that you might have experienced yourself. Number one, awe in nature. In the 1830s, Ralph Waldo Emerson delivered a set of lectures on nature that formed the foundation of American Transcendentalism, a movement that rejected the analytic hyperintellectualism of America's top universities. Emerson argued that the deepest truths must be known by intuition, not reason, and that experiences of awe in nature were among the best ways to trigger such intuitions. He described the rejuvenation and joy he gained from looking at the stars, or at a vista of rolling farmland, or from a simple walk in the woods. Quote, "Standing on the bare ground, my head bathed by the blithe air, and uplifted into infinite space, all mean egotism vanishes. I become a transparent eyeball. I am nothing. I see all. The currents of the universal being circulate through me. I am part or particle of God." End quote. Darwin records a similar experience in his autobiography. Quote, "In my journal, I wrote that whilst standing in midst of the grandeur of a Brazilian forest, it is not possible to give an adequate idea of the higher feelings of wonder, admiration, and devotion which fill and elevate the mind. I well remember my conviction that there is more in man than the breath of his body." End quote. Emerson and Darwin each found in nature a portal between the realm of the profane and the realm of the sacred. Even if the hive switch was originally a group-related adaptation, it can be flipped when you're alone by feelings of awe in nature, as mystics and ascetics have known for millennia. The emotion of awe is most often triggered when we face situations with two features: vastness, something overwhelms us and makes us feel small, and a need for accommodation, that is, our experience is not easily assimilated into our existing mental structures. We must accommodate the experience by changing those structures. Awe acts like a kind of reset button. It makes people forget themselves and their petty concerns. Awe opens people to new possibilities, values, and directions in life. Awe is one of the emotions most closely linked to the hive switch, along with collective love and collective joy. People describe nature in spiritual terms, as both Emerson and Darwin did, precisely because nature can trigger the hive switch and shut down the self, making you feel that you are simply a part of a whole. Number 2. Dirkheimagens. When Cortes captured Mexico in 1519, he found the Aztecs practicing a religion based on mushrooms containing the hallucinogen psilocybin. The mushrooms were called Teonanacatl, literally God's flesh in the local language. The early Christian missionaries noted the similarity of mushroom eating to the Christian Eucharist, but the Aztec practice was more than a symbolic ritual. Teonanacatl took people directly from the profane to the sacred realm in about 30 minutes. Figure 10.2 shows a god about to grab hold of a mushroom eater from a 16th century Aztec scroll. Religious practices north of the Aztecs focused on consumption of peyote, harvested from a cactus containing mescaline. Religious practices south of the Aztecs focused on consumption of ayahuasca, Quechua for spirit vine, a brew made from vines and leaves containing DMT, dimethyltryptamine. These three drugs are classed together as hallucinogens, along with LSD and other synthetic compounds, because the class of chemically similar alkaloids in such drugs induces a range of visual and auditory hallucinations. But I think these drugs could just as well be called dirkheimagens, given their unique, though unreliable, ability to shut down the self and give people experiences they later describe as religious or transformative. Most traditional societies have some sort of ritual for transforming boys into men and girls into women. It's usually far more grueling than a bar mitzvah. It frequently involves fear, pain, symbolism of death and rebirth, and a revelation of knowledge by gods or elders. Many societies used hallucinogenic drugs to catalyze this transformation. The drugs flip the hive switch and help the selfish child disappear. The person who returns from the other world is then treated as a morally responsible adult. One anthropological review of such rites concludes, quote, "These states were induced to heighten learning and to create a bonding among members of the cohort group, when appropriate, so that individual psychic needs would be subsumed to the needs of the social group," end quote. When Westerners take these drugs, shorn of all rites and rituals, they don't usually commit to any group, but they often have experiences that are hard to distinguish from the peak experiences described by the humanistic psychologist Abe Maslow. In one of the few controlled experiments, done before the drugs were made illegal in most Western countries, 20 divinity students were brought together in the basement chapel of a church in Boston. All took a pill, but for the first 20 minutes, nobody knew who had taken psilocybin and who had taken niacin, a B vitamin that gives people a warm, flushed feeling. But by 40 minutes into the experiment, it was clear to all. The 10 who took niacin and who had been the first to feel something happening were stuck on Earth, wishing the other 10 well on their fantastic voyage. The experimenters collected detailed reports from all participants before and after the study, as well as 6 months later. They found that psilocybin had produced statistically significant effects on 9 kinds of experiences. 1. Unity, including loss of sense of self and a feeling of underlying oneness. 2. Transcendence of time and space. 3. Deeply felt positive mood. 4. A sense of sacredness. 5. A sense of gaining intuitive knowledge that felt deeply and authoritatively true. 6. Paradoxicality. 7. Difficulty describing what had happened. 8. Transiency, with all returning to normal within a few hours. And 9. Persisting positive changes in attitude and behavior. 25 years later, Rick Doblin tracked down 19 of the 20 original subjects and interviewed them. He concluded that, quote, "All psilocybin subjects participating in the long-term follow-up, but none of the controls, still considered their original experience to have had genuinely mystical elements and to have made a uniquely valuable contribution to their spiritual lives," end quote. One of the psilocybin subjects recalled his experience like this, quote, "All of a sudden, I felt sort of drawn out into infinity, and all of a sudden, I had lost touch with my mind. I felt that I was caught up in the vastness of creation. Sometimes you would look up and see the light on the altar, and it would just be a blinding sort of light and radiations. We took such an infinitesimal amount of psilocybin, and yet it connected me to infinity." End quote. Number 3. Raves. Rock music has always been associated with wild abandon and sexuality. American parents in the 1950s often shared the horror of those 17th century Europeans faced with the ecstatic dancing of the savages. But in the 1980s, British youth mixed together new technologies to create a new kind of dancing that replaced the individualism and sexuality of rock with more communal feelings. Advances in electronics brought new and more hypnotic genres of music, such as techno, trance, house, and drum and bass. Advances in laser technology made it possible to bring spectacular visual effects into any party. And advances in pharmacology made a host of new drugs available to the dancing class, particularly MDMA, a variant of amphetamine that gives people long-lasting energy, along with heightened feelings of love and openness. Revealingly, the colloquial name for MDMA is ecstasy. When some or all of these ingredients were combined, the result was so deeply appealing that young people began converging by the thousands for all-night dance parties, first in the United Kingdom, and then, in the 1990s, throughout the developed world. There's a description of a rave experience in Tony Hsieh's autobiography, Delivering Happiness. Hsieh is the CEO of the online retailer Zappos.com. He made a fortune at the age of 24 when he sold his startup tech company to Microsoft. For the next few years, Hsieh wondered what to do with his life. He had a small group of friends who hung out together in San Francisco. The first time Hsieh and his tribe, as they called themselves, attended a rave, it flipped his hive switch. Here is his description. Quote, "What I experienced next changed my perspective forever. Yes, the decorations and lasers were pretty cool, and yes, this was the largest single room full of people dancing that I had ever seen, but neither of those things explained the feeling of awe that I was experiencing. As someone who is usually known as being the most logical and rational person in a group, I was surprised to find myself swept with an overwhelming sense of spirituality, not in the religious sense, but a sense of deep connection with everyone who was there, as well as the rest of the universe. There was a feeling of no judgment. Here, there was no sense of self-consciousness or feeling that anyone was dancing to be seen dancing. Everyone was facing the DJ, who was elevated up on a stage. The entire room felt like one massive united tribe of thousands of people, and the DJ was the tribal leader of the group. The steady, wordless electronic beats were the unifying heartbeats that synchronized the crowd. It was as if the existence of individual consciousness had disappeared and been replaced by a single, unifying group consciousness." End quote. Hsieh had stumbled into a modern version of the muscular bonding that Ehrenreich and McNeil had described. The scene and the experience awed him, shut down his I, and merged him into a giant we. That night was a turning point in his life. It started him on the path to creating a new kind of business embodying some of the communalism and ego suppression he had felt at the rave. There are many other ways to flip the hive switch. In the 10 years during which I've been discussing these ideas with my students at UVA, I've heard reports of people getting turned on by singing in choruses, performing in marching bands, listening to sermons, attending political rallies, and meditating. Most of my students have experienced the switch at least once, although only a few had a life-changing experience. More commonly, the effects fade away within a few hours or days. Now that I know what can happen when the hive switch gets flipped in the right way at the right time, I look at my students differently. I still see them as individuals competing with each other for grades, honors, and romantic partners, but I have a new appreciation for the zeal with which they throw themselves into extracurricular activities, most of which turn them into team players. They put on plays, compete in sports, rally for political causes, and volunteer for dozens of projects to help the poor and the sick in Charlottesville and in faraway countries. I see them searching for a calling, which they can only find as part of a larger group. I now see them striving and searching on two levels simultaneously, for we are all homo duplex. The biology of the hive switch. If the hive switch is real, and if it's a group-level adaptation designed by group-level selection for group binding, then it must be made out of neurons, neurotransmitters, and hormones. It's not going to be a spot in the brain, a clump of neurons that humans have and chimpanzees lack. Rather, It will be a functional system cobbled together from pre-existing circuits and substances reused in slightly novel ways to produce a radically novel ability. In the last 10 years, there's been an avalanche of research on the two most likely building materials of this functional system. If evolution chanced upon a way to bind people together into large groups, the most obvious glue is oxytocin, a hormone.